And this is the Made of Clay Report, digging deeper into the issues that make and break our lives. And we're going to start now with a song that our guest has picked, and we'll do the introductions right now. Our guest for this hour is Eloise Barrett. Eloise, welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
And we're going to start, Eloise's first selection for today is a song entitled Safe in His Arms, and it's a Vicki Winans recording, and I think it's, and so we'll enjoy it now for a few minutes, and then we'll start our conversation.
Thank you.
Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, digging deeper into the issues that make and break our lives. And our guest for this morning, for this hour, is Eloise Barrett. Eloise, good to have you here.
Thank you, Eric.
And I guess what I'd like for people to start is just with a little bit of a thumbnail sketch showing who are you? What are just some labels that you willingly put on yourself?
I'm a daughter, mm-hmm. a sister, a wife for 32 years, recently widowed, a loving mother, a grandmother, a mentor, an advocate, an educator, mm-hmm. and a caring friend. And I'm a person with strong values and beliefs that mm-hmm. were instilled by my parents and grandparents.
Mm-hmm. And do you want to say a little bit about who you are in terms of the sort of person you are rather than the label? Because I think those beliefs begin to get at that. And also at the selection of your music.
I guess one of the things in terms of my strong values and beliefs is that I love, you know, gospel music, inspirational music, music that uplifts. And I feel like that is what I try to do is someone that is dedicated to the educational advancement of underrepresented youth and to empowering and uplifting and fostering quality relationships and networks that allow people's needs to be met.
So these are values that are lived in relationships with those who would not necessarily have what you've come to have.
Yes.
Yeah.
And shared. Right. You know, I have 5 amazing children, 14 beautiful grandchildren.
Wow.
And 11 siblings, 9 that are still alive. So I've been a foster parent. I have godchildren and many children that I did not birth biologically, but that were birthed from my heart. So I try to just share that with those that are around me and those people that I love and those that I come in contact with.
Right, right. And how to be a mother and a mentor as, you know, 2 M words rolled up in one.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me, you know, what, you know, with all of those roles, with that attitude towards life, what major experience kind of shaped you into this mother mentor role? What brought you here?
Well, both of my parents are from the South. My father was originally from Tennessee, and my mother was from Mississippi. And my mother often told us stories about growing up in Mississippi and how she was not aware of the racism and some of the issues in the South. And my father would tell us stories about how his grandfather could not publicly acknowledge them because they could pass.
Oh, I see.
So they could ride on the front of the bus, but the grandchildren had to board the back of the bus. And, you know, some of the things that they taught us and the stories that they shared with us in terms of the times that they lived in helped us to realize that we had a lot to be thankful for and grateful for. Both my parents moved up here to the North and, you know, they didn't know each other, but they eventually mm-hmm. found their way up here and they got married. And my grandmother, also being from the South, had moved up here, and she had moved to Ithaca.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what originally brought us to Ithaca. We were in Rochester originally. Mm-hmm. Then my grandmother moved to Ithaca and bought a piece of property back in the 50s, I believe, mm-hmm. 59.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
57, 59, somewhere in that, mm-hmm. The late mm-hmm. 50s. And she started work, like a mission work, a church work in her home.
Mm-hmm.
And then my father started traveling back and forth from Rochester to Ithaca to help my grandmother with that work.
Sure.
And so our life has just been a life of service and dedication. It's been a life of, you know, growing up in the church, values and beliefs that have shaped our lives and who we were.
Sure. Sure. It's the church with the backdrop of migrating out of the Deep South and mm-hmm. into the North, where the racism hits in slightly different ways, but every bit as much.
Yes.
Yeah. So how did you? Because of what brought you to this area is in part your grandmother. How did your grandmother decide to settle in Ithaca and not, say, in Rochester? Because that's kind of an unusual northern migration.
Yes, and I'm actually not sure. She was in Rochester for a while, and she was also in Batavia for a while. and then moved to Rochester. And she was in Rochester because of the church there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she was actually helping with the church there in Rochester. And then when her and my grandfather moved to Ithaca, I'm really not sure, you know, was it a job or exactly what it was that brought them from Rochester to Ithaca.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But they found a place here in Ithaca, and that's where they moved.
Right, and back in the 1950s, only about 2% of a population of 50,000, so only about 1,000 people were African American mm-hmm. in Tompkins County. And now it's 100,000 and about 5,000 African Americans.
Yeah.
It's a different place.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And at the time, my grandmother bought that property. It was over on what is now named after my father, Cecil Malone Drive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it was then Clinton Street, and there was no Super 8. There was no Wegmans. There was no Tops.
Right.
It was a fairground. There was the city dump.
Not far beyond, yeah.
Yes.
Yep, yep.
And so that whole history of, you know, coming back and forth to Ithaca, and then eventually in the early 60s, we also moved down here.
Mm-hmm.
And my father began to, you know, help my grandmother more with the church and was appointed to be the pastor, and he began to build a church.
And that was also the banks of Six Mile Creek, too.
Exactly.
And I doubt that that had been channelized at that point or made safe from flooding.
No.
No.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. So we had all of those issues also.
Wow. And it's true. I mean, people who are marginalized by their identity or their resources get the worst quality land.
Mm.
But at least you got land close to the city.
Yes.
Yeah. So tell me about, you know, actually let's take a little another musical break now. What would you like for us to play next?
I think maybe I Will Trust You.
Okay. And that's Trust Me? No.
Yes, Trust Me.
It's the fifth one, right? The Richard Smallwood.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's what we had to do a lot of times in our life.
Yep.
Trust
is a big issue. It's the biggest issue both in and outside of people who consider themselves religious. It's a matter of faith in a generic sense.
Yes.
Thank you.
And that's Richard Smallwood and Trust Me. And our guest on this hour is Eloise Barrett, and this is the Made of Clay Report with Eric Clay on WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. So, Eloise, tell me what this concept of trust, this idea of trust me, has meant to you. The line goes, I am that I am, I have all power, I will deliver, if you will only trust me, trust me.
I feel like that has, it really speaks to me in a way in which we have lived our lives always depending on God to provide and to make ways. Obviously, you know, we didn't come from a lot of money or anything like that, but we knew we had a faith and a trust in God that he would protect us, he would deliver us, he would make ways. Being from a large family of 12 children and, you know, my mother and my father and, you know, he was pretty much, once we moved to Ithaca, self-employed, he did a lot of hard labor. He was what you would call probably a jack of all trades. He did building and masonry and carpentry and mechanics and all of those things. And
a bivocational minister.
Yes.
Or actually tri or quattro or...
Exactly, yeah, yeah. Exactly. Right. And so, you know, all of those things that he did so he could provide for his family. And so it wasn't that we knew there was going to be a certain paycheck coming in every day or every week with a certain amount of money. It was that, you know, we had to be resourceful and we had to take what we had and we had to live with that. And so not only were we providing for, you know, the family, not only was my father providing for the family, he was also... We always seemed to have other people living with us.
Right.
And we lived in a three-bedroom house, you know, small home, you know.
And how many of you were with 12 siblings, how many of you were there at one time?
There was a time there were 12 of us, plus about three others, children, plus my mother and father. And we had one bathroom, three bedrooms. So there was the girls' room, the boys' room, and the parents' room. And that's how we survived.
Right. I know... A small taste of that. I grew up in a two-bedroom house where my four sisters had one room, my parents had a room. I was on the couch, my brother was in the pantry, and my brother was on the back porch. Mm. Another brother was either in the crib in my parents' room or in the living room. We had an outhouse, so we had a similar, but nowhere near the kind of density that you're talking about.
Yes,
it does either make you or break you on some level.
Exactly. Now, but those were good times, and so that's how you can maintain that trust, because you know that he did take you through all of that. And
what made them good?
What made the times
good? What made those
good?
Times good?
I think it was the family and the love and just good times, enjoying being together. When you kind of come from a large family like that, and, you know, you're... Sisters and brothers are your friends. You don't necessarily have to look for friends outside the house, you know. So we had good times. We enjoyed it. And we didn't know that we were poor because we didn't have certain amount of resources financially. Right. It didn't mean anything. We were still very rich in our love and our family. More of our family moved to Ithaca, and we had cousins and, you know, sisters and brothers, and then we had the church family. So we had a lot of wealth in terms of, you know, emotional and social kinds of support and the spiritual support.
A lot of wealth
support.
In relationships.
Exactly.
And one of the things that poor people, especially living in high-density environments, know that the experience they have is the one they make. And you make the good times or you make it sour. Figuring out how to keep people positive in that environment is a task. But my guess is that was what made the good times for you, is that you had to do it together, and you knew that if you didn't, you wouldn't make it.
Exactly. And it wasn't, I guess the only task that it was trying to, you know, make sure, you know, my mom insisted, you know, the house was clean and this was done and that was done. And we all had our chores and everybody working together. But it wasn't a task about, you know, being happy and being able to work together and go into school and get in our education.
Right.
Those were just givens.
Right. Right. You just, yeah. Right.
You just
right,
did
right,
it.
Right. Right. You did it because you had to make it so that everyone could survive, and not just survive, but thrive.
Exactly.
And I did, I in a similar way, I didn't know that I was poor until I came to Cornell on a full scholarship in 1976. And in my first year, one of the hardest lessons for me to learn, and I'd begun to learn it a little before because I had the opportunity to be an exchange student even out of where I was coming from, but was to learn that I was poor by American standards, and that was hard because you don't quite know whether you fit or whether you can trust your intuitions or not when you're around people who seem to have a completely different understanding.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it was a very similar experience for me, except for I didn't learn that until much later in life. When I started working at the Youth Bureau, actually, and that was when I began to, you know, be socializing in among people who were different than I was, and, you know, my family, African American, the church was, you know,
it was your whole
predominantly African American, and we had Caucasians and other people of other races in our church, so it was multicultural, but you know, it was all, we were all there for a common purpose, which was to serve the Lord. So even in those situations, those that were different from us racially, it didn't bring anything different to the table in terms of economics or wealth or anything like that. And that emphasis was not there. You know, it really was about the trust and the belief and the worship and the spirit being one in the spirit and being unified in that.
Right, right, and I'm gonna step out on a limb a little bit here, just because I think that there are a lot. I mean, in Tompkins County, we're about half folks who are non-religious, and sometimes non-religious folks who haven't been exposed to the kind of the depth and sophistication of religious language don't get it. And I want to talk a little bit about what I hear in your use of trusting God, and in secular terms, trusting God is trusting the reality of what is and what's possible, that it can bend to the good for you if you really work with it in realistic ways, not fantasy ways,
right,
not self-serving ways, right, but realistic ways.
Yes.
Have I caught that quality right?
Yes.
And God's not this magical, mystical white guy or black guy or whatever. God's not a guy anyway. God is a
spirit,
a quality of reality that is and is good,
yes,
if we know how to engage it.
Exactly.
Nothing spooky about it.
No.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. So when I say that, a lot of people challenge me that I'm not representing people of faith in a true way, but I think we're talking the same language here.
Yes. Yes. God has always, you know, is before, you know, he says, I'm Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. And so he always is, he always was, and he always will be. And therefore, you know, we're able to really trust that because he has been consistent.
Right.
And a lot of times what causes people to have distrust or mistrust or lose faith is because of the inconsistencies. And when those inconsistencies happen and things are no longer the same, it's very easy to lose your faith when things happen that really rock your beliefs and your...
Right. When things happen that hurt you or hurt those you love, when reality is not kind in your terms, when you've not gotten what you feel like you deserve, or you've really been slammed. But one of the things I think people trip on is the male pronoun. When he does this, because you're talking about when the reality that is before us and after us and during our whole time, when that when we're in touch with that reality, things work.
Exactly.
And when we're out of touch with it, we're at odds with it.
Yes.
And there's a profound sense in which that connects to a lot of folks at that level.
Yeah.
When did you start working for the Youth Bureau?
25 years ago, in 1988, I believe it was, I had my last son in 87, and I was home taking care of my kids, and I got a call, and some of the things that I had done in the church, some of the programs that my father and I had started in the church had to do with literacy and educating people for reading and writing and for life. And in those you know, programs that we were doing and the things that we were doing to help those that were a part of our church. People had heard about it, knew about it, and when an opportunity came up at the Youth Bureau for a program that was newly started, some people found out about it and called me and said, you know, do you want to come in and apply? And I did, and the rest is history.
Wow. And it opened your life. Did they intentionally recruit you out of a community to become this person who kind of could cross the boundaries? Or do you know?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I think it was clearly about the program mm-hmm. that I was recruited for was the Paul Scherz Memorial Program.
Sure.
And so it was a program that had been inspired by a Eugene Lang story and a story of a young man who had grown up poor in Harlem mm-hmm. and had went on to become a self-made millionaire. And one of the volunteer big brothers had heard that story and had told his family and supervisors at the Youth Bureau that he wanted to be able to do the same thing for his little brother he was working with. Unfortunately, he died in a tragic accident. Upon his death, his family contacted the Youth Bureau and said, you know, we want to make this a reality. So they were talking about turning dreams into reality.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm, sure. And that, you know, dream was to be able to help send two or three kids to college. And when they called me, part of that was also knowing, and even Eugene Lang had realized that it wasn't enough just to say to a group of sixth graders that if you graduate, we'll help pay for your college education.
Right.
They needed some support along the way, and that there were a lot of other social issues and emotional mm-hmm. issues and academic issues that would come up in those 6 years, that if there wasn't somebody there to support them, if there wasn't this network of support, that they would continue to just fall through the cracks, as they would say, quote unquote. So
right. Well, you have to have a community around you your whole life.
Exactly.
You know, and if you haven't, it's hard to build it. And once mm-hmm. you build it, you can't abandon it because it's you got to keep it.
Right, and that is what we started out to do, is to build that network of support and mm-hmm. build those connections and relationships, so that between the mentors and the tutors that the students knew that they had that support, and they also had that consistency
mm-hmm.
and that there was going to be somebody consistently there for them. So even if they did fail or fall or have trouble or if they stumbled, there would be somebody there to help them find their way back on track, mm-hmm. to help pick them up, to help dust them off mm-hmm. and encourage them.
Right. And one of the things about consistency when I was doing, and I eventually went on to get a doctorate in community and economic development, and I mm-hmm. studied communities in Harlem and Detroit and Chicago, some of the poorest and most mm-hmm. violent communities in the U.S. And what I learned was consistent mentoring, consistent relationship is not a 1 or 2 year commitment. It's a 10 or 20 year commitment. Mm-hmm. And you take the first year or two just to figure out if you're a match. But you're on for life.
Yes.
You're on for life. Yeah. And many people try to found mentoring programs. You can make little changes, but that's a very middle class, and dare I say, middle class, affluent African-American, middle class white way of doing business on these short-term relationships. They don't work for the long haul, not for what you're trying to do.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because we do ask our mentors to make a minimum of 2 year commitment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The tutors a 1 year commitment.
Sure.
But it is true that the longer the relationship, the stronger the relationship and the more trust that is built.
And the bigger the benefit.
Exactly. Yeah. And the students do better. And sometimes it's not necessarily the volunteers that are able to make such a long-term mm-hmm. commitment.
People can't do it up front. That's the irony of it. You can't make that a commitment, but you can live into it.
But then that's where I feel like I become that mentor,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
so that even as others come in and do their portion, there's still that strength of stability and that foundational support of a mentor who is there. I was thinking about how on last week we were at a funeral mm-hmm. and I saw some of my students that I had worked with when they were in middle school and high school. And the one young lady said to me, her son, who, you know, she had is in her first year of college, was now in college.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just like, whoa. You know, and so those kinds of moments, you know, when, you know, they can embrace you and you see these young people who have gone on with their lives and they're adults and they're having families and building families. That is that long-term relationship beyond just those 6 years of mm-hmm. high school mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. secondary school.
And I want to say this explicitly because it's implicit in what you're saying, is that you are the person who takes up when people need to leave the area and leave their mentorship, that you try to keep that relationship or that feeling of connection alive. And sometimes kids are ready to let it go to somebody else, but it has to be attended to. And if it's not intentional, if the transition is not intentional, people get lost.
That's true.
And your role is incredibly vital in this community for just that reason, to keep people from getting lost.
Thank you.
So
one of the things that we, one of our philosophies that we've adopted at the Youth Bureau is the circle of courage.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the quadrants of that circle is belonging and, you know, trying to make sure that people feel that they belong. And so just what you were saying, you know, made mm-hmm. me think about that. When you create that feeling for our young people that they belong, you can then begin to build on these other things of generosity and yeah. independence and mastery.
Yep. Yep. So let's take a music break. What song would you like to play next?
I believe Abide.
Abide, okay.
Which is by Lexi.
Okay, and we are going to start about just a little bit in. It has a really long lead.
Okay.
Okay. That's Lexi and Abide. And our guest is Eloise Barrett on the Made of Clay Report. And you're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is Made of Clay Sunday Report. So, Eloise, you were talking, we were talking briefly while the music was playing about how the word abide means to dwell and to consistently be in and to reliably and trustworthy remain a constant presence in one's life and in one's place. And you were talking about your father's farm and some sustainability stuff. You want to say more about the connection to sustainability and poverty and how we abide with each other?
Yeah, when we first moved to Ithaca, we lived downtown. And so we were down there until 75. But just before 75, there was a movement. My father, being a pastor and traveling and starting churches in other areas, he had brought a large group of people up from the South. Mm-hmm. And we ended up purchasing some property in 75 out in Danby. Mm-hmm. And it was a mini farm. Mm-hmm. And so we had, you know, fruit trees and we had land, a few acres of land. And we took that land and we started, you know, growing food and having livestock and, you know, the chickens and the eggs and all the cows, all of those things. So, you know, that we could grow food, that we could have food, that we could learn how to, you know, live on the land and take care of the land.
And you were pretty well grown by that point.
I was.
And you were on the land, too, with them.
Yes.
Yeah. So you have to learn these skills as a young adult.
Yes. I had just graduated from high school. And my father had asked me to delay my scholarship. I had received a scholarship to go to college. Mm-hmm. And he had asked me to delay that because we were right in the process of trying to move. Mm-hmm. And that I would stay and help my mom and get, you know, things settled there on the farm. And, you know, and that's what I did. And so I was out there, too, learning to, you know, plant the corn and, right, you know, take care of the animals. I was afraid of the chickens, but
they can be kind of nasty animals too. You know,
took care of horses and, you know, cows and.
And your father did this because he had learned these skills in the South, and then translated them here, or was he learning this all along the way, himself?
I would say he may have learned some of those skills because his grandfather had a ranch, but he raised horses. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of those things of, you know, like canning and preserving foods, sure, those were things that my father's mother did also, and right, making homemade rolls, and my mother made homemade mm-hmm. rolls. And so, you know, I think it had been a long history of learning to be resourceful, take what we had and make what we wanted. And, yeah, so it was really learning to be sustainable before it became a popular movement.
Right.
And, you know, other people started seeing the necessity of it. But he always seemed to be a man ahead of his time.
Right.
So we used, you know, we used the apples from the orchard to make apple jelly, apple sauce, apple butter. We took the fresh cow milk and we learned to make butter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we did all those things. And we just had to learn whatever we had. We knew it wasn't like if it got broken, we could just go replace it. Mm-hmm. We had to learn how to maintain it, how to take care of it, how to fix it if it was broken. And that was, you know, any of our things, the equipment, the vehicles, the bicycles, the animals, each right. other. We had to fix it and we had to make it work. And I think that not only did that work on the land, it also worked in our lives in terms of if it got fixed, if it got broken,
you fixed it.
You didn't just
whether it's
it.
A tool or a relationship.
Exactly.
Now, what I want to say, I think we live in a culture now which assumes affluence. And in the assumption of affluence, people kind of can buy what they need. But and so the only within this environment, poor people look just like dysfunctional, and often are treated as though they had no prospects because they have no money, and if they have no and if the system's against them, then they have every reason to not believe that they need to try. But when you're poor with an attitude that you can make something, even if it's a little of nothing, you haven't internalized poverty as a disease.
Right.
And what you're talking about is how to inoculate yourself, or how to recover from having labeled yourself as somehow not worthy. Because even with modest resources, you can do something.
Yeah. And I feel like that was the lesson that we learned, you know, because being poor was never a label that I feel any of us took on ourselves.
Sure.
I think had we done that, if we had accepted that label, if we had even known that word, I think we may have had a harder time and a harder struggle trying to overcome that. But because we didn't know that, and for, you know, some reason in some way, you know, my father, God, we were protected from that. And it was that whole resourcefulness, you know. So for as long as I can remember, we were always taking care of and serving others. We loved doing it. We had fun and we made the most of it. So even, you know, with 12 children, I remember we had, when we lived downtown, we had neighbors who were white. And the little girl would come and she would eat at our house all the time. So, you know, that was one of those things. You know, when we went to school, we would walk to Henry St. John, and we didn't know that we were poor because we didn't stay at school and eat lunch. We walked home because we thought we were so special. My mom would have a hot lunch for us when we got home. So we might have soup and a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, but we thought we were...
It was homemade.
Exactly.
And the bread was probably homemade, too.
We thought we were, you know, doing really well because we could walk home and our mother had hot lunch waiting for us, and it was good, and, you know... And my mother was resourceful like that, you know. Yeah, we had the surplus food, but we didn't even feel, you know, she could take that cheese and slice it up and make good grilled cheese sandwiches and the meat or whatever it was in those cans and make some stew and soup and, you know, pulled pork, you know, sandwiches. And we thought we were good. Yep. So it didn't, poverty didn't come into our vocabulary until I was really grown, before I realized, because we always had so much more to give. So no matter what we
had, more than you needed,
we always had something to give. If I had a sandwich, you had half.
Yeah.
So if that's all I had was a sandwich, I still had something that I could give. And that was just, it was just part of who we were and what we grew up thinking and believing.
And those are skills to be proud of. And yet we live in a culture that might want to make us ashamed of them. Because we don't necessarily have the bells and whistles and the stuff. So how did learning that you were poor affect you, or mess with your mind, or mess with your heart? How did it challenge you?
I think initially I was kind of, you know, embarrassed. You know, I was kind of embarrassed to think, oh, wow, you know, we were poor, you know, because on the standards that they were talking, and, you know, I believe we were in a workshop at the Youth Bureau, and so the standards that they were talking about and being able to do certain things and whatever, you know, we were poor, and I couldn't put my mind around that, and I was sort of embarrassed to think, you know, like, what do these people think, you know, like, what am I doing here? But It was a fleeting thought, really, because, you know, you go back home and, you know, there's so much warmth and so much love and so many resources, and you really didn't lack anything because, you know, one of the things that I remember growing up, we didn't have TV. So we didn't have anything to compare ourselves to. We weren't watching TV shows, and we weren't looking in magazines trying to see what other people were doing. This was our life. This was our community, and we made it what it was, and it was rich, and it was full, and it was fun. And, you know, I mean, we traveled. We would go to Michigan and Arizona and Pennsylvania, and, you know, my father being a minister, many times we had opportunity to travel with him. You know, my grandparents would come, and they would stay in Ithaca in the summers and go to Arizona for the winters. And so, you know, seeing things like that, you know, it still was like, okay, you know, but not necessarily realizing fully that it was for health reasons,
right,
you know,
right, right.
But it was always that, you know, and then, you know, we were property owners, you know,
yeah.
So we might have had a house in the poorest neighborhood or on the banks, but we had it, you know, and that was one thing, you know, we had the property,
yeah.
And my father was able to acquire a few other properties that he was able to rent out and fix up,
yeah.
And we would be in there painting and hanging sheetrock and fixing up apartments that people tore up, and
right.
We just had fun doing it.
Right.
But like, you know, when my mother passed away, the attorney looked at us sitting around the table and he said, anything divided by 12 or 15 is nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of hit me again, you know, kind of that whole sense of, you know, no matter what you had and no matter how much you
mm-hmm.
had
mm-hmm.
in other people's standards, it didn't seem like it was sufficient. And people
mm-hmm.
could never figure out, you know, how my mother made do with the resources
right.
that she had to take care of a family that size. But, you know, it was possible because God was with us.
It's possible because there's always more resources than you're fully aware of. And the matter is to just get creative enough that you
mm-hmm.
can engage them.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I don't think we ever adopted, you know, I know I didn't. I never adopted that mentality of poverty.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I think that that has a lot to do with it, which is one of the things I try to encourage our students, you know,
mm-hmm.
not to be so easy to accept the labels that people put
yeah.
on them.
Yeah.
So oftentimes, you know, people want to put negative labels on the students,
right.
you know, about their learning, about who they are, about where they come from. But to help them understand that, you know, you have to think better of yourself
mm-hmm,
than maybe
mm-hmm.
what somebody else would choose to label you. And you
right.
don't have to accept those labels, but you can choose what you want to be called.
Right. Don't participate in your own humiliation. Just because somebody else is ashamed of you doesn't mean you need to be.
Exactly.
And I that took me a while to learn.
Yeah.
Because I came when I came to Cornell, I talked with a lot of nasal twang, and I came. We said used to could, and I talked a funny language, and I'm overdoing it a little bit, but not a lot. And you know, it just doesn't have a place. And I had to kind of figure out how both to be different, but also not to internally judge myself. And it's a tough row when you come from poverty.
Yeah.
And we haven't figured out how to. I mean, the people who are most dangerous are those who have a lot of resources and no purpose.
Exactly.
And we have way too many of them in this culture.
Mm.
Way too many. Let's go to another song. What would you like to go to next?
I think maybe Withholding Nothing.
Okay. And this is a William McDowell song, Withholding Nothing.
Yeah.
And that's William McDowell, Withholding Nothing, and our guest is Eloise Barrett. Eloise, a couple of questions before the show is over. One is, how have you changed?
I feel like there's been a lot of things that have happened in my life recently that has changed me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the major, I think, things that have happened that have changed how I feel and how I go about my life now is, you know, death. Mm-hmm. When my father was killed in 1980, and then my mother died, and then my husband just recently died in 2012.
Right.
So all of those things have definitely changed me as I have learned to really, you know, going back to trust, really trusting in God, you know, mm-hmm. because, mm-hmm. you know, the supports and the protection and those people who were there for me and around me who really helped, they were there. And there's a book that we had at work, and it was called How Full Is Your Bucket?
Right.
And it talks about, you know, we all have this invisible bucket mm-hmm. that, you know, we can use to use our invisible dipper to give to others. And mm-hmm. the song Withholding Nothing, a lot of times, you know, growing up the way we did, we just poured everything of ourselves into the work, into mm-hmm. the church, into the mission, into the farm, into each other. And we were constantly pouring and withholding nothing.
Right, right, right. And people who live life fully withhold nothing. They are not consumers. They are not dabblers. They are not art experts or judges of the rest of the world, because they're just living full mm-hmm. throttle.
Yes.
And that's a perspective on life that we as a consumer society have lost.
Yeah. And what was interesting for me and what changed me is after my husband died, you know, it was almost like a massive death, because not mm-hmm. only did I lose my husband, the church community and the family there at the church that I had,
yes.
I lost all of that.
Because of the leadership transition.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So at that point in time, you know, I received a letter that said I was no longer a member in good standing. So after 50 years of being there and pouring, you know, our lives and making so many sacrifices, because not only was my father the pastor, my husband was the pastor
right,
for 23
right.
years.
Yeah,
so, yeah. And so that the church was my life. It was, you know, really defined who I was.
And it was changing.
And it was changing. And so... So initially, the shock of all of that really, you know, kind of was like an earthquake.
Yes, yes.
The song
yes.
that says, I feel the earth moving under my
right.
feet.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
that's
yeah,
the
yeah.
kind of thing that I felt, you know, is that, you know, my whole life and my whole world was turned upside down. And for some reason, I guess I felt like, you know, the people that you pour yourself into, they're also the ones who should be there for you when you need them.
But they're often
but they're
not.
But they often not.
No,
and that's
right.
what I
it's
found
not a,
out.
It's not a transaction.
Exactly.
It's not a reciprocal relationship. People take what they need where they can find it. They give what they have where they can. And
yes.
it's not a back and forth.
Exactly.
So,
and my daughter gave me a quote. Actually, she just gave it to me last night. And she was saying something to me about God will never create a void that he is not able to fill.
Yes.
And he will never allow you to experience pain that he will not heal. And with that, I learned, and many people were telling me that, but I wasn't sure how to do that.
Right.
But, you know, through all of the change and transitions that we've experienced since my husband's death, I've been, you know, had the opportunity to have so many other people now pour back into me. So when I had emptied myself and my life into one thing, now I've had the opportunity to have other people to be able to surround me, people who are already filled, people who are already doing things, people who are positive, yeah. to be able to now take their invisible dipper and pour into me. And I see as I go along, it seems like daily, on a daily basis, I'm being refilled
right.
and I'm being
right.
re-gifted. And I'm being recreated and reinvented into the person that God really would want me to be, so that I can also be able to continue to give back.
Right, right. But you have to be able to accept what others cannot give you and what others still others can.
Exactly.
And that is powerful. And you just asked the last, you just answered the last question of the show, which is, what do you do to sustain yourself? And this is the biggest perspective on that question I think anybody's ever given. Mm. So, Eloise, it's wonderful to get to know you a little bit.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Eloise Barrett, and this is the Made of Clay Report, digging deeper into the issues that make and break our lives. And we're going to close with a song that she picked, Take Me to the King. Do you want to say anything about it or just play it?
I think we can just play it. I think it speaks for itself, is that when I have nothing else to bring, just take me to the King.
Yeah.
I'm tired, options are few. I'm trying to pray, but where are you? I'm all churched out, hurt and abused. I can't fake what's left to truth is I'm weak, no strength to fight, no tears to cry, even if I tried, but still my soul refuses to die. Take me to the King. I don't have much to bring. My heart's torn in pieces. It's my offering. Lay me at the throne. Leave me there alone to gaze upon your glory and sing to you. To you. don't have much to bring. My heart's torn to pieces. It's my offering.